Gentlemen, with that gavel, I have convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for March the 11th, 2015. We are gathered today for the purpose of a public hearing on Senate Bill 5508, the Employment Department. We would invite up Director Nissenfeld and anybody from Team Employment that you deem appropriate for the opening gambit.
Okay, come on. Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson.
Well, actually, before you start, if you don't mind me interrupting you, Madam Director, I'm going to turn to our professional staff from LFO and ask if you have any opening comments before we get going.
Madam Co-Chair, not really. Your materials are posted under March the 11th, under Meeting Materials. There you will find the Legislative Fiscal Office overview, which highlights a few of the issues that you're likely to hear today, but I don't want to steal their thunder. And also a full copy of the governor's budget document is also included there, as well as the agency slide deck. The CFO presentation, I believe, is posted for under tomorrow's meeting materials. So,
okay. Now, Director Nissenfeld.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Nissenfeld, and I am the director of the Oregon Employment Department, and happy to be with you today sharing the new directions and ideas we have for the organization and workforce development in Oregon. So I want to start with our operating principles. Whoops, delete would be bad. Okay. We've a set of operating principles we've been using in the last year and a half. I think are principles that you'll see throughout state government recently, and that is first that decision making really needs to move to the local level to the extent possible, because local economies know better than we do about what needs to happen in workforce development. We also need to have our strategies led by employers. While we have great ideas amongst staff, employers have the immediate and convincing knowledge of what needs to happen. And finally, we need to optimize all resources available, which means we need to reach beyond our own borders and work with every dollar that moves out there. So I'm going to go through real quickly the changing workforce and why this gives such an urgency to the work we're doing. First of all, you're well aware, as am I, with my personal retirement hopes, that the baby boomers are retiring. That's leaving a large gap in the workforce, and one that is especially challenging because the increased need for skills has developed around technology. So technology has changed pretty much every occupation out there. And so that increase in technological demands, while we're losing mid to upper level workers through the workforce, has really become a problem in our economy. Also, we're seeing that fewer young people are working than ever before. We did a study last year that pointed out that about 25% fewer young people are working. And there are a variety of reasons for that, most of them having to do with the economy. But it's resulted in many challenges out in the workplace, where we're seeing that people can get out of high school or even out of college without ever having held a job and knowing that your mother can't write you a note to get you out of work. So we're working on that one as well.
My mother. That would be frozen.
The other really operating issue we're seeing, particularly in areas like manufacturing, people are in those jobs a shorter period than they ever were in the past. So the National Association of Manufacturers reports that the average tenure in a manufacturing job is 4 years, making many employers question whether training people is economically advisable if they're just going to lose them that quickly. And so it's a little bit of a revolving door out there with many companies.
Madam Director, that just begs the question of this panel has just been listening to Boley's presentation, and we had had another informational meeting on DBE contracting, and talking about the value of employers training apprentices through journeymen. And if you're seeing what I consider an alarming trend in people staying in jobs a shorter period of time and employers questioning the efficacy of training, do you see that rippling over into apprenticeship?
You know, I see it as making apprenticeship more important than ever, because it means that the skills someone learned on a job, even if it was for a short time, if it was in an apprenticeship structure, that's transportable to the next job. And so if those credentials can follow the individual, which is what apprenticeship does for us, then everybody wins. So the employers can find other people participating in apprenticeship because there's a more tightly controlled pool of workers. I think it's a design that we are very interested in expanding to many other occupations because of these trends.
Thank you. That's an optimistic note against your other earlier comments. Thank you.
Well, it's part of why we need to change, because we've kind of, frankly, ignored apprenticeship.
One other question, and I didn't give you the courtesy of telling you I was going to ask you this because it only really came into my understanding recently, and that is that I'm hearing for some rather traditional careers, particularly law enforcement, that there is now a different mindset with some of the younger applicants, that instead of seeing this kind of career opportunity as a career, that they're really viewing it much more as an 8-to-5 job and are interested in weekends off and are interested in not a lot of overtime. And have you been tracking at all any of the millennial attitudes towards the workplace in any kind of scientific way? Are you aware of any literature and any literature searches?
I know that our research people have done some work on this, particularly in their youth report last year, but I'll ask what they particularly are tracking. Everything I know is simply anecdotal from my 3 adult children.
Good field research. Go ahead. Please, continue.
The critical issue we're seeing in our economy right now is skills. So I came to this job from being president of an economic development organization, and at the time, skills were the number one issue that companies would come to us with. If they couldn't get the workers with the skills, they didn't get the business. And so that's a huge issue. One of the I had lunch with a friend recently who's still in economic development, and her comment when I asked her if jobs were still the number one issue, and she said, yes, jobs are the number one issue, jobs are the number two issue, and jobs are the number three issues. Getting skilled workers for those jobs is the huge issue in economic development. So if we want our economy to work, we really have to pay attention to these skill issues.
Madam Director, is it that the skills are the wrong skills being taught for today's jobs, or is it that we're graduating people so absent the hard and soft skills that they don't qualify? What, when you say with the right skills, speaking Chinese, for example, yeah. I think not that many years ago that would have seemed like an unfathomable prerequisite to do business in global trade. Some people might argue right now that it's essential. So when you say right skills, what are you talking about?
Well, it's an ever-moving target. And so, but an example I like to use is several years ago in economic development, we had a company come to establish steel fabrication jobs in our area, and they could find entry-level people, people with the soft skills. In their case, they could find the soft skills, but they couldn't find the people to supervise the entry-level people, so the skilled machinists and steel fab people were not available. Overnight, their job orders went to South Korea, because you can't produce it, you don't have the jobs, period. So it's a kaleidoscope of ever-changing needs. You know, I found it ironic that when I got together with a bunch of metal fab companies and asked them what skills are you missing, and they said manual machining. Well, 20 years ago, you had the same conversation with a bunch of companies like that, and they would say CNC machining, computer-controlled machining. So it's always changing and evolving, and the challenge in workforce development is to stay on top of it. So later on, we're going to talk a little bit about how we're trying to stay on top of that through our partners with CCWD and others in the field with sector strategies that try and get companies together to talk about those needs and help us focus our resources on what will approach those needs. And they're different in different parts of the state, which is why it's so important that we work that locally.
Thank you.
So the goals of the system are fairly ordinary, I guess. We want high-wage jobs for high-wage jobs, which demand high skills. When I started in this business, low-skilled jobs that paid well were the goal. Those jobs have since departed for other parts of the world. We need to help people get the skills that will earn $15 an hour and more and be competitive in the global economy. Businesses have to have those skilled workers in order to grow. And finally, that we run a system that works with all our education partners and others to produce those workers on a timely basis. When we talk about workforce, and we can go into this in much more detail at another time if you like, we have a whole presentation that we put together around different skills and which parts of the system work with populations with these different issues. But we tend to group these populations in the system, and the first four are typically the populations addressed by the current workforce system that we're involved in. The last two, professional and highly technical workers and super skilled workers, by which I mean astrophysicists, for example, are typically addressed through the university system. So we won't spend a lot of time on that today, but if any of you are interested in learning more about that, I would be happy to talk about it. We've been asked a lot of questions about how state government is organized around workforce development, and we have a variety of agencies that have a substantial role. And so you'll see that at OED, we have three major departments. Our Business and Employment Services, which is the department that works with WorkSource. We have staff in WorkSource across the state, and you're going to hear more about that later. WorkSource, however, is a joint animal between us and the local workforce boards. So we don't own it. We collaborate with it. We are part of it, a big part of it. We have, of course, unemployment insurance, and David's going to be telling you more about that, and our research department. Now, we've developed a fourth unit within the building in the last 6 months or so, and that is an interagency unit with the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And we call it the PI, Policy, Innovation, and Evaluation, and that they're administering federal funds, job training funds, to be consistent with the programs we are also running, and that has been of great value to all of us in developing a system planning and evaluation capability, as well as their funding is the other funding that goes into WorkSource, so through the local areas. So that's been very helpful in the last year. Other players, of course, in our HEC and BOLI in their apprenticeship programs. DHS has two programs in particular, self-sufficiency programs and Voc Rehab, that are involved in the workforce system, and the Commission for the Blind is also a player in those. Again, I would like to emphasize that while we are all involved in these systems, the services are delivered locally. We have oversight.
Madam Director, would you elaborate on that? The programs delivered locally.
Yes. The WorkSource centers, for example, we have 37, that's an ever-changing number, throughout the state, and those are in collaboration with the local workforce investment boards. And so we will have probably 70% of the staff in each one of those, and then the local subcontractors of the workforce boards will have the remainder. They tend to focus on the training, and referring people to training is the plan, and our staff focuses mostly on the placement, and that's the WorkSource part of it. Community colleges are a huge part of the equation. That training is often in community colleges, and those are locally based and locally run. And community-based organizations we rely on to help us with special populations. So we don't try and be everything to everyone. We try and springboard our work off the work of others.
Go ahead, please.
So the Oregon Workforce Investment Board is our oversight body. You may recall that we were placed under their oversight about a year ago. And that board is constituted under the Workforce Investment Act, which will soon change to the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, WIOA. And that board includes leaders from private sector, state agencies, local agencies, and organized labor. The board develops this 5-year strategic plan, which we're looking at revising in the coming year. And it helps keep us honest by holding our feet to the fire in terms of data, both in unemployment insurance as well as the WorkSource programs.
Would you mind getting to the professional staff a list of who all is on that board right now, and so that it can be passed out to the committee? And
absolutely.
Remind me, I should know this, who's the appointing authority for that?
The governor's office. The governor. We also have an oversight council, also appointed by the governor, for unemployment insurance principally, called the Employment Department Advisory Council. That's a small group of people. I think there are 7 members, and they meet quarterly, and they're beginning to function as a subcommittee of the OWIB, focusing specifically on the unemployment insurance portion of the organization.
Do you need them both, or is that working to have them functioning as a subcommittee of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board?
I think it's working. There hasn't been any conflict at this point, and that's when you know you're having a problem. They're both appointed by the governor, and they're both in statute, so it's a little... we can't subsume them as a subcommittee of the OWIB, but there's a little bit of overlap of membership, and they've been able to kind of finesse that. So.
I'm just thinking, colleagues, of how many boards and commissions exist, and I think we all welcome volunteers to come into the process and help advise agencies, but some agencies have got a multiplicity of advisory
right.
boards, and I would again respectfully ask that you would get to the professional staff a list of all of the advisory boards that you've got,
okay.
not just this big one.
We have also had the Oregon Employer Council, and we made a decision about a year ago that after this June, we would no longer be staffing that organization. It is a little bit different animal. They weren't really acting as an advisory body. They were working more to help local companies learn human resources law and regulations and best practices. And that's a little bit outside of our bailiwick.
You know, I find that interesting. My husband and I were small business people for 30 years. I never saw one of those guys, ever.
Yeah.
Sorry, I mean, I don't mean to brook a criticism, but yeah. I just think it's interesting.
Once we were under the jurisdiction of the OWIB, it did feel like it was an extra board and body that was not terribly focused on our needs. And so BOLI is working closely with them, is my understanding, to help meet their other needs.
Thank you.
This is how we're organized. I'd like to point out that the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is the second box from the left in the middle, we are suggesting that they move to DAS, and we'll talk about that more later. Gary Tyler will be here to talk with you about the reasoning there. And we have also included on the far right side the Planning and Innovation Unit, which is the interagency unit I discussed earlier. So recent shifts we've made in the organization, you're going to hear about some of these more in a few minutes, so I won't belabor them, but we held a variety of discussions in the regions around the state last year. We'll talk more about that. We're reorganizing OED staffing in WorkSource. We've reduced the management positions within WorkSource by 26%. We're just finding that we need more frontline workers and fewer managers. We have subtracted IMATCH skills from the equation for the public. We realized early on that trying to compete with the private sector by supporting a job match tool was, you know, just not in the cards for us and not very effective. So we're not doing that anymore. We're using that time rather to do more one-on-one work with clients. So helping them navigate that online system that's already out there. We have spent a lot of time over the last 2 years rebuilding our information technology capacities. It's no secret that that's been a stumbling block for us in the past, and I'm sure you're all well aware that we had a very serious breach, security breach, last year in October, and we will be providing you with a variety of details about that in tomorrow's meeting. But rebuilding that capacity has been, particularly in terms of personnel, has been what we've done in the last 2 years. We'll begin to move forward on replacing some of our technology, which is still operating in languages that are mostly dead. So COBOL being the principal one, we really need to update those systems. We can't find workers who still remember how to speak COBOL.
Madam Chair.
Representative Reed.
I can't resist pointing out that I had a fun experience recently reading a book, or I shouldn't say reading, listening to an Audible recorded version of it called The Innovators, which tracks the development of the computer industry and technology and so on. I learned in that book that something you may already know, COBOL was developed in World War II, just for the scale of how old COBOL is.
For some of us, Representative Reed, who remember those years immediately after World War II, your characterization of being ancient is very hurtful.
I never said that. I said technology from World War II.
Please continue.
We also are working hard at developing performance management data and a system for that data and using our own research department to help us do that. We're looking there for accountability and for improvement of the system as we go forward. We've worked hard at reducing bureaucracy, whether that's the number of signatures it takes to buy trivial items or reducing friction in the system between the state and the locals. There's no need for us to spend time on, you know, who's in charge here or who can make someone do something. We're kind of all in this together. We've got to move forward. This is an urgent issue. So reducing that friction has been a major priority, and I think we've been pretty successful at it.
Madam Director, when you have multiple agencies, and I applaud your effort to try to work between agencies, but when you have a client that is served by multiple agencies, is there a tracking mechanism to keep track of the services that are offered to a client, or is that a DHS function? Is that, are you just a vendor to DHS in terms of employment skill up, or how do those connections work?
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, yes. There is a system that tracks services and employment services. There are a couple of systems. DHS, we do not track TANF services, but we do contract with DHS in a variety of places in the state. It's not consistent. But in those places where we do, we track the employment services and report that to them. But we do not track the other human services that people might be receiving. But within the players in the WorkSource system, there is a unified tracking system.
And one last question on that same theme. Do you use any outside vendors to provide any of your services that you have contracts with to do service delivery?
Madam Co-Chair, at the Employment Department, service delivery is all handled through state employees.
Okay. So no contracts with not-for-profits like the housing model, or you're using all in-house employees to discharge your mission?
I believe so. Am I forgetting anything? Okay. No. Our partners in the local workforce investment boards are required by executive order to contract out their services. Those contracts are often with community colleges or community-based organizations or others. So we work with their contractors, but we do not contract our services.
Okay, and who? What's the contractual relationship between the not-for-profit and who?
The local workforce investment boards. So
okay.
You'll be hearing more about them. They are There's one starting up in your region, for example. We've had 7. We're moving to 9 in the state. And they each get an allotment of federal workforce money through CCWD. And part of that is to run WorkSource, and part of it is to do things like sector strategies and training in companies.
How burdensome would it be to get a list of those vendors, the services that they provide, and the financial terms of the agreements?
It shouldn't be difficult, although it's in major flux right now. So we can give you a photograph of what has happened in the last year, knowing that next year it's going to look substantially different, and the year after that, even more. The state has given existing service providers a sort of a grace period. All services are required to be bid out in 2016, so there'll be more change at that point.
Well, that would be great if you could go ahead and get that again through the professional staff to the committee.
We'll do that.
Thank you.
We have also spent time in the last year and a half reducing our staff to pre-recession size. Our business is one that goes up and down with recessions. And you'll see a graph on that later in the presentation. And then finally, building a sense of urgency around our mission. And so change doesn't happen without that sense of urgency about how this is critical to businesses and workers in the state of Oregon. And so communicating that sense of urgency to our staff and getting that buy-in is very, very important. Last spring, we held 12 forums and focus groups around the state. I know that Representative Hildreth Whitsett participated in the one in Klamath Falls, and we had over 700 people participate, partners, businesses, educators, workforce boards. They were very informative. And the basic questions we asked in these was, essentially, we've been doing the same thing as the employment service for 80 years. We know they were not going to suggest that we stop issuing unemployment checks, but the remainder of what we do, is it time to look at some shifting and changing? So some of the things we learned from employers, which is not surprising, is that applicants are lacking in basic skills. That's reading, math, the ability to do basic everyday work functions. They're clearly lacking in technical and vocational skills. Early work experience, again, with 25% fewer of our youth having worked a job, they're missing that experience that teaches them how to work. So that work readiness skill is going down even further. Now, I also want to say that I've been in this business for over 30 years, and I've heard for over 30 years that the youth of today lack work readiness skills. So some of that's just what we always say, but some of it is more serious right now. Generational values, kids not working, parents not teaching those values. So there are just many things at work there.
Do employers comment on anything that has to do with drug affectedness or the difficulty in passing your analysis?
I was just going to get to that. Absolutely. Particularly in rural parts of the state. And it became very clear to us in those parts of the state that we cannot move forward merrily along as a jobs program without linking forces at some level with organizations that are doing that work, because there's something that's got to give there. In those rural areas in particular, we also saw workers holding many jobs. In our system, we tend to think about a job and a worker, and yet in rural areas, people tend to hold multiple jobs in order to form a living, so that we've got to start thinking about helping people establish a living, not just have a job. Frequently, that's going to include self-employment or some kind of entrepreneurial activity. Of course, longer commute times in rural areas. And then the last one was ironic almost, in that there is a real challenge with the availability of professionals in rural areas. But what we heard also in rural areas was that young people don't believe there are any jobs that are going to be available to them. So their belief of young people and their teachers and their families is that they'll have to go to the city to get educated, but they won't be able to ever come back. And at the same time, hundreds of jobs requiring professional skills going begging in those parts of the state. So just anecdotally, we have asked our research department, we have researchers in 24 sites around the state, to connect with those local high schools and students and their families to talk about what jobs will be in those local areas. So we'll begin to dispel that myth a bit. We also developed a strategic plan in response to these forums, as well as legislative input and others. Again, the goals seem pretty obvious: to provide an effective unemployment insurance system, connect businesses and job seekers, collaborate with community colleges and workforce development so we have a talent development system in the state, to collect labor market data that informs our decisions. We often did not use our own data to inform our decisions about where services need to be. Co-Chair Gomberg was a witness to some of that early on. And then finally, to strengthen department performance. We know we need to do better. And, you know, we're not trying to make a secret of that. We know we have to add more value. So that value, improving the value of workforce services, it's got to mean more to people. We have to be able to, if you were to send a loved one to Worksource, we need to know that they came back and got much closer, much faster to getting a job, that we are all in that business of getting people back to work. We're retooling our unemployment insurance processes. There are many layers of policies and procedures, and David will talk about that a little bit more, but we need to unpeel some of that and make it simpler and more straightforward. I've already spoken a bit about modernizing our technology and the urgency of that. We also are committed this year to prepare for recessions. We've got a team that has started work on saying, what do we need to do so the next recession doesn't hit us like a surprise? Because every time it does, and we all go, ah, you know, there are a million people in the Worksource centers, there are a million people filing for unemployment, we don't know what to do. We should know what to do. We've been down that road before. We'll have a plan ready. And you'll hear more about that in a minute as well. We want to increase sector-based training investments so that, again, led by employers, that we're working at that sort of that wholesale level of knowing where those training investments need to be, and we find ways to provide incentives to get our partners to put their training money there. Adding more capacity, more training to the system. That's one of the things we heard out in the field was job placement's great, but we need training to go along with it. And so, again, connecting up with CCWD and our training partners, particularly through apprenticeship, is going to be a very important strategy for us. Moving the Office of Administrative Hearings to DAS is one other priority for the year. And then finally, aligning our KPMs with our federal measures and other measures. So we've had work groups from the OWIB working on performance measures. The feds are going to be publishing new performance measures. And we have yet again a separate set of KPMs. In the coming year, we're going to try and make those all the same thing. So they're close, but they measure it slightly differently. So that we're constantly saying, well, which one do you mean? And how is that calculated?
I'm going to ask the professional staff to flag that, because there has been a tendency, you haven't been around long enough, there has been a tendency in agency land to change up the performance measures with frequency, particularly when goals are not being met. And some of us that have been around for a little while are getting increasingly resistant to that notion. Conversely, pretty soon you're tracking so many performance measures, it's easy to take your eye off the ball of actually doing the work.
Right.
I mean, back in the good old days when we used to set power poles with helicopters, were we on time? Were we under budget? Did we do it safely? And did they call us back? Were about the only performance measures we needed. Some agencies have had upwards of 17, 18 performance measures, and it seems pretty burdensome to track those. But just to tell you, as a new agency head, there may be some resistance, and you might want to work very carefully with your LFO staff and your Office of the Chief Financial Officer to make sure that as you're harmonizing your federal and state key performance measures, that you know you're headed into shark-filled waters.
Thank you, Senator. We'll certainly be thinking of that.
We're just doing the Jaws thing.
Representative Whitsitt.
So we've talked about this at length, and in the meeting that I was at down in Klamath, what are we going to do when the employers say the number one problem with finding someone to work for them are drug addiction or drug abuse problems in their employment workforce. And, you know, we're talking about areas of the state that have the highest unemployment. We have jobs there, but we do not have people who are drug-free and able to do them. And so, I mean, I think it's been close to a year, I guess, since we had this meeting, and that's the thing you heard the most. And I recognize you're not, you know, drug abuse and all this is not your ballywick, but if that's the primary thing that is preventing rural Oregon from becoming productive, which is what we heard certainly in my area, what are we? You know, how are we going to handle this?
Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Woodsett, members of the committee, I wish I could speak more knowledgeably about what we are doing. I can speak hypothetically and then would like to loop back with you so we can get more than hypothetical in your area in particular. I think one of the things we can do is to work closely with whatever drug treatment programs are out there to assure that when people complete those programs successfully, that they have entree to a job fairly quickly.
Yeah.
And that whatever training programs are out there, that they do not exclude people who may also need to be time in a drug treatment program. So there are many issues involved there. They get very complicated when it also begins to involve arrests and probation and parole. And I mean, life gets complicated quickly. But in each region, I believe we have to work closely together to figure out who are those players and how do we form a coalition of the willing as opposed to trying to force people to work together and in order to move forward.
And if I could follow up, one of the problems that I would just like to say for whoever is living out there in TV land is we don't have drug abuse programs to get people off the drugs. We don't have psychiatrists. We don't have counselors. We don't. These parts of rural Oregon are just sitting there with virtually nothing. And so, and this is more of a statement, it really doesn't relate to you, but we have a massive problem and it is not even beginning to be addressed. Also, alcohol and, I mean, the rural areas are devastated by drug problems, as you heard. I mean, you heard from the employers one after another. They came into this and they just said, our workforce is addicted. And what do we do? I mean, that went to the front of the, you were making lists all around the room, and it's what everybody said. I mean, and you said we had the largest turnout of employers in the state, including the metropolitan areas and everything. People came forward to say, we have no workforce because they're drug addicted or alcohol addicted. I mean, it's just a terrible problem that we've got. And I don't think parts of urban Oregon are getting the devastation that we're having from this. And we can't go forward if we don't have people who are capable of working. So thank you for letting me say that.
Thank you.
Please continue.
To launch into our budget this year, you'll see that we have, at this time, no general funds. The majority of our funds come from the federal government, and those are declining resources. The majority of our funds also go to unemployment insurance benefits. So that's demonstrated by this chart. That big blue bite, dark blue, is dwarfs the rest of our budget. Those are the unemployment benefits that are paid through the Unemployment Trust Fund principally. And David will talk more about those later. That's about a little over 85% of our budget. Of what's left, unemployment insurance, the administration of unemployment insurance occupies about 54% of the budget. Business and employment services, about a little over 40%. And research, about 5.88%. We did not include the Office of Administrative Hearings in this pie. That's a $28 million chunk. So because they're not in our budget, they're moving, but we can put them back if we need to. The income, where the money comes from, is principally from the U.S. Department of Labor. These are dedicated and restricted funds, and many of them are pegged to the unemployment rate, not all of them. But they come to us with very clear restrictions of how we may spend them. Then there are a group of other funds. You're going to hear me talk a little bit more about the Supplemental Employment Department Administrative Fund, lovingly known as CDAF. That's 0.009% of trust fund receipts. And that comes to about a $72 million income source in the current biennium. We also get income from penalties and interest, fraud control, and other charges, such as our DAS contracts for services in WorkSource. This chart shows you how in the 2009-11 biennium we were flush with funds, principally through unemployment during the recession, and then other funds coming through the stimulus programs. In the coming biennium, we expect to be at a fairly low level. There are two one-time funds that come into play in the current budget. The first is READ Act. Those are the bars on the left-hand side of this chart in purple. READ Act is the federal unemployment tax that the federal government holds in a pot, and when it gets to a certain point, they release it to the states when there's a certain overage. And that happened in the 2001-2003 biennium, I believe, or somewhere thereabouts, maybe a little earlier. I've been told that in my lifetime we won't see that happen again because that fund was completely depleted during the recession. So that money, we anticipate spending to a zero balance by the end of the next biennium. And the other one is our modernization fund, Unemployment Insurance Modernization. There are not a lot of federal strings on this, but the intention was that it be spent for modernizing the technology in unemployment insurance. And that's, we have been carefully watching other states' unemployment insurance technology modernization. We believe we'll be ready for major investments in that, not in the coming biennium, but the subsequent biennium. You'll see requests from us for the coming biennium be fairly small. And the bulk of those funds then go into the next biennium to help us purchase those systems. And you're going to hear a lot more about that. I've never really liked the term right-sizing the agency staff, but in this case, we grew large during the recession when our services were much more in demand, and we needed to get back to our pre-recession size. You'll see a large jump downwards in July of 2013. That represents the 81 positions we gave away with the child care division. So if you take them out of the equation, right now we're even with where we were in terms of FTE in pre-recession numbers. And that was our goal to get there. The CDAF fund this year, the governor's requested budget is proposing that we move $37.9 million of CDAF funds into the general fund, and then also proposing that those funds move into the HEC budget for these workforce programs, most of which would go to the local areas. So youth employment programs, the $10.9 million, about 80% of that would go to training funds. $6 million for Oregon existing worker funds, and another $6 million to the Community Leverage Fund, which is part of the Regional Solutions strategy. Getting those funds back into the system for workforce is really important, and we realize that that does not happen through this committee. It will happen through the Education Sub and the other broader Ways and Means Committee, but I want to emphasize how important that is to us. I think we've met with all of you individually to explain how we wound up with an ending balance that permits this to happen on a one-time basis. I want to emphasize that it is a one-time basis. If this happened again in a subsequent biennium, we would be laying people off like crazy because we will not have large ending balances. So that's where that comes from. We've also been working on cost containment throughout the agency. If you are around employment for the last year and a half, you'll know we had what was called the hiring frost. That's how we were able to get down to our right staff size without laying anyone off. We took retirements and net attrition as it came, and then reassigned people to get to the right numbers. We're also trying to establish more of a collaborative network of employment services, again, realizing that the unemployment insurance folks, it is in their best interest and our best interest to get people back to work as soon as possible. So they're working more collaboratively with the people in WorkSource. We also, in the last two quarters, consolidated our unemployment insurance call centers from Eugene and Milwaukee. We had two large centers in each place, and we realized this was a very painful process for those in Eugene. The centers were relocated to Beaverton. We saved $40,000 per month net through that consolidation. So that was a very important move for us in order to be able to continue to provide services in unemployment insurance. We have also been restructuring our field operations, and I'm going to let Jim Farr tell you more about that later. And we have reached our span of control of the 1 to 11. I'm not sure which decimal point that comes down to, but we're there if you round up at least. And I do want to acknowledge that that's been a challenge because we have so many small field offices. And I'll leave it at that.
I'd like you to elaborate, because that was somewhat of an artificial construction that was a legislative mandate, but in some agencies it hasn't worked well, and I know that agency heads have worked hard to achieve what the legislature told them to do. Could you comment, other than you've got dispersed locations, on what other aspects of difficulty or success you have encountered with that 1 to 11 ratio?
Well, I think part of what happens is that you end up having people who are now dubbed lead workers, who formerly we would have recognized as supervisors. They're doing supervisory work. But to get to the number, we can't call them supervisors. I'm not sure I should be showing our dirty underwear quite like this, but it seems unfair. We have people in the unemployment call centers where they might be supervising a couple dozen people, which is not always as effective as we need it to be. It feels like a very artificial constraint. Yes, in central office, we should be able to get to those numbers. In our call centers, we should be able to get to those numbers. But when we have to factor in that we have many offices with fewer than 10 employees, you start doing gymnastics elsewhere in order to make up for that. So it's not, it doesn't always make the most sense.
Thank you.
And at this point, if there are no further questions for me, I'm going to turn this over to David Gerstenfeld.
Thank you very much, Director Neisenfeld. Colleagues, any questions for the director? Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Director Neisenfeld, I have to say I spoke with you the other day in my office, and I don't really have a question. I just want to just make a comment of two things. We get a bunch of different agencies through here, and I have to say that you didn't really pat yourself on the back enough, I don't think. When you talked about discontinuing the iMatch skills, that I think is a big deal for a state agency to say, hey, the private sector is providing this, and so on our own, we're going to discontinue this service. I think that's a level of, I don't know what word I'm looking for, a level of maturity or a level of management effectiveness or whatever that we don't always see. And then I would say the same thing for the call center consolidation. That's kind of contrary to the empire building kind of thing that people see. So I just want to, I don't think you patted yourself on the back hard enough for either one of those things. So I'll just do it right now, and you can comment on that if you like.
Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg, Representative Nierman and the committee, thank you very much. I'd like to pat David Gerstenfeld on the back for the UI consolidation and the workers that had to accomplish it. It was not an easy task. And I'd also like to acknowledge the role that DAS played in that, a big one, of their new strategy of requiring us to work with real estate agents in a competitive market and be a competitive client in that competitive market. And it it made a huge difference.
Good.
So, but I appreciate the positive feedback.
Thank you for your leadership.
Thank you. Well, with that bouquet toss introduction, it might be a good segue to Mr. Gerstenfeld. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please, and start your presentation.
Certainly. Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. I'm David Gerstenfeld, the administrator of the Unemployment Insurance Division. We'd like to talk a little bit about just the structure of the Unemployment Insurance Division. We have three main organizational units. One is the group that pays out benefits to workers. The other is the group that gathers the money so that we can pay the benefits, so they collect quarterly tax reports and then also the tax payments from businesses throughout Oregon. And the third handles our kind of unemployment insurance-wide issues, so that's federal compliance, lots of reports, policy issues, training, process improvements, things like that.
Let me just ask you, if you got a call from a new business that was trying to set itself up and they had questions about how to do their unemployment insurance, where would you refer them? Because I don't think you do case management. You're doing the internal mechanics of getting the money in and getting it out. Tell me where you would send somebody with a question about how to structure their payroll to accommodate their UI.
Co-Chair Johnson, we do provide assistance to employers that call up with questions like that. We can't advise them, like, for instance, you should set up a corporation or not, but we do work with them about here's how to report it, here's how to do your initial registration to become a business. With the initial registration, a lot of that work gets done through the Central Business Registry run by the Secretary of State, and we're a part of that along with the Department of Revenue, Department of Consumer and Business Services, and some other agencies. So we refer, if they have questions specifically about the wage withholding aspect, we would refer them to the Department of Revenue. But we do try to answer the questions that businesses have about how to set up and how to file the reports and things of that nature for the unemployment piece.
Thank you.
It seems like deja vu all over again. I mean, didn't we ask this series of questions just 2 days ago? I appreciate the good work that you're doing with the telephone services that you provide, your ability to answer questions, and I'm curious about similar kinds of programs that are available in other agencies. And you mentioned the Secretary of State's office and their new Office of Small Business Assistance, but we also heard recently from the Technical Assistance Branch at Labor and Industries and the telephone assistance programs that they have there. And so my question is about overlap, redundancy, or whether we're just providing a number of different options to reach out to a market that's really bigger than all of our combined resources can address.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, I think for the unemployment insurance program, there's not that much overlap. We get lots of people that have questions that hit on the unemployment insurance program and maybe other employment-related matters that really aren't anything that the Employment Department has jurisdiction over. So we'll answer the part of the question that we can and refer them. BOLI, in their technical assistance unit, for instance, doesn't give out detailed information about how to set up their unemployment insurance reporting. They would refer that to us. We do try to communicate. For instance, BOLI has told us when they've seen an increase of questions about unemployment insurance so that we can try to communicate better and to make sure we're referring to the correct places. So there's a lot of connections between the different agencies. At least for the unemployment insurance program, the types of questions that we get, there's not a lot of actual overlap, I don't believe, of substantive answers being given.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. So the purpose of the unemployment insurance program is to provide a safety net for people who become unemployed to temporarily replace part of the wages that they were earning. It's to help them and their families. It also helps the local economies, both by mitigating the effect of lots of unemployed people leaving when they lose their job. That helps maintain some spending levels in the economy. It also helps make sure that when things pick up again, there's a skilled workforce there in the local area. And as Director Neisenfeld mentioned, we're really working on connecting even closer with the rest of the workforce system so that we're not just providing the safety net, but that we're helping them move off of that safety net into employment as quickly as possible. Unemployment insurance is a partnership between the federal government and the state government. The partnership takes on different forms at different times. There's some pretty strict requirements that the federal government has that states must comply with in terms of how the program operates. And then within that framework, there's leeway for state-level policy and for variation. The incentive that states have to stay within that federal framework is both that administrative funding that we receive to pay for operating the unemployment insurance program, and also a credit that Oregon businesses receive against their federal unemployment tax. That's the FUTA on pay stubs. As long as Oregon stays consistent with the federal requirements, Oregon businesses receive a credit against most of their federal FUTA obligation. If Oregon businesses were to lose that, it would be about $500 million a year in additional federal taxes. So we take the requirement to stay consistent pretty seriously. And this is just our attempt to visually represent the flow of money in the unemployment insurance program. When you look, the red line is what we have the most control over. That's the state-level unemployment insurance tax and benefits. So we collect the tax from employers. It comes into the state unemployment insurance trust fund that I'll talk about in a minute, and that's used to pay benefits to workers. That doesn't actually pay to administer the program. The blue line that says federal is the FUTA tax. That goes to the federal government. They hold on to that and primarily distribute that to states in the form of that administrative funding. And Lisa mentioned that in the past, when they had excess funding, they would then release that in READ Act distributions. This shows a number of...
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Gumber.
That's quite all right. Excuse me for interrupting. And let me put this question in context. I want to say that I really appreciate your proactive work and the wonderful communication and the support that you've provided. I wanted to talk about the unemployment rates that insurance rates that small businesses pay. And you and I have had this conversation before, and I've referred to the magical mystery formula that determines how much an individual business will end up paying. And one of the elements of that formula is the number of separations that would qualify or be affected a business may encounter. And my question is the concern that in particularly rural communities, seasonal industries are going to have more separations because they are seasonal. And I wanted to invite you to comment a little bit on that and whether that ultimately increases the rates that businesses, particularly small businesses in seasonal economies, may end up contributing to your fund.
Coach Johnson, Coach Gomberg, that's a good question, and it's really difficult to give a nice, concise, here's how it works. It really is proportional based on the amount of wages that the worker has earned. So in some cases, if there's a lot of people that work seasonally and that's most of their income, then those businesses would tend to have a disproportionately high tax rate. If it's a situation, and sometimes there's overlap of this, where there are a lot of people that have multiple seasonal jobs and they go from one job to another, if the work that they have for your business was just a small portion of their earnings, then it just has a proportionally small impact on your business's tax rate. So it really varies a lot, and it's hard to give a uniform answer, and that's something I can be happy to try to give more useful, specific information to either you or the committee if you'd like additional follow-up.
We'll continue to talk about that, but thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Co-Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Our trust fund is solvent, correct?
Coach Johnson, Senator Monroe, that's correct.
And we keep it solvent because we adjust the tax rate during down times, correct?
Correct, Senator.
Not all states do that.
That's very true, and that's one of the things that I wanted to highlight for this committee is that Oregon set up by statute a self-balancing formula so that we don't have to revisit whenever conditions change or the trust fund balance changes what to do. So in general, as the trust fund balance goes down, there's a little bit of lag time built into the system so that employers don't get hit with an increased tax rate during the height of an economic downturn. But the tax rates do go up, and then as the trust fund replenishes, we move into lower tax schedules.
Are we still currently near the top rate?
Coach Johnson, Senator Monroe, no, we have actually moved. So there are eight schedules represented here,
right,
and the circles are which year we were in which rate. So we were in the highest tax schedules for 3 years.
Yeah.
In 2014, we dropped down two schedules to Schedule 6, and we're currently in Schedule 5. So we're pretty close to the middle right now, and that reflects a pretty healthy trust fund.
And continue, Madam.
Follow-up.
And isn't it true that those states that don't maintain a solvent balanced program like we have can borrow money from the federal government at zero interest?
Co-Chair Johnson, Senator Monroe, they can borrow money, and that's something I was going to talk about to highlight that Oregon did not have to do. For the zero interest, it gets complicated. They have a certain amount of time where there's no interest charged. If they do not pay it back within a certain amount of time, then interest does begin to get charged. There are various waivers. There are a couple of states now that are paying interest. As of January, there were a total of, I believe, 17 states that still did not have a solvent trust fund that had borrowed money. Some of them had borrowed from the federal government, as you described. Some had borrowed on the private bonding market. But in all of those situations, the employers do have some increased tax burden to repay the borrowed money, and when there's interest, they have to repay that as well.
One more vote.
It's always troubled me that we have a solvent system that we've carefully crafted to always maintain the balance. Many states don't do that. They can get money for little or nothing that essentially is subsidized by us and other states that are solvent.
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Johnson, Senator Monroe, that's true, and that's something that the Oregon Employment Department pointed that out to the U.S. Department of Labor as they were having discussions about whether interest should be charged at a certain point and some other reforms. That, frankly, is something that probably will get a lot of attention at the national level, as there's still a number of states that are going to struggle to have a solvent trust fund before the next recession hits.
Good. Needs to be fixed. Thank you.
Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Monroe, members of the committee. I also recently read an article that there are states that the repercussions of this have been very painful. So it's not just that they get to borrow money for free and then pay it back over time. The state of North Carolina, for example, has cut its unemployment insurance time in half. So instead of qualifying for 26 weeks, you can only get 13 weeks. And the payment has gone from over $600 a week to $300 a week. So the price that's being paid in those states is substantial. And we ought to be proud that Oregon is not doing that.
Well, I am. I'm very proud of our system. And I want it equitable so that our Oregon taxpayers aren't subsidizing those states that are acting frivolously.
Thank you. Please continue, Mr. Rosenfeld.
Thank you, Co-Chair. And there are also repercussions on the businesses. And in a couple of those states, the businesses have actually lost part of their credit against their food or tax obligation. So this really is an area. Oregon and Washington were the two states that have vied back and forth for the two most solvent trust funds nationally. Some of the challenges that are facing the unemployment insurance system, one is adjusting to the post-recessionary workload. So it's nice to see people getting back to work. Our workload goes down. As Lisa mentioned, our federal funding also goes down. And the unemployment insurance funding tends to be generous during the recession and much less generous as you leave a recession. So that's a challenge that we're facing. We do have some outdated and multi-layered business processes and IT systems, and Lisa talked about that, and I'll mention it in a little more detail in a moment. Making sure that we're making payments as accurately as possible, and that's something that I spoke to this subcommittee about a couple of years ago and to many others. During the recession and through the aftermath of the recession, balancing getting payments out quickly to people and being as accurate as possible has been a challenge. Oregon had been well over 10%, which is the federal standard for improper payments. This measure shows that we dropped below that. We're still slightly above the national average, and there tends to be a bouncing up and down in the rates, but Oregon is on a general trend of reducing the improper payments and also getting much better at finding them when they happen and recovering those for the trust fund.
Would you go with me a little walk back in history? Was there not a time when we had a very significant problem in the multi-million dollar range? And I want to know about that. And then what efforts were made, if any, to recover that money that was improperly distributed?
Co-Chair Johnson, there was a very significant problem. It's still an ongoing challenge and, frankly, always will be. because it's a weekly payment system and it's high volume. We've improved a lot. I think it was about 3 years ago there was a big push nationally to give information about how this was impacting the unemployment insurance system. At that time, Oregon's improper payment rate was, I believe it was 13.54%. And of course, there were a lot more benefits being paid out at that time also. We were paying out sometimes over $2 billion a year in benefits. So that meant a very large amount of benefit overpayments. We've done a number of things to recover those funds for the state trust fund and when they were federal benefits that were paid for the federal government. Some of that has been operational changes. We've changed our staffing. We've changed how we use the information that we have to try to both educate people better up front so there's not kind of the innocent errors that cause overpayments, and also so that we can more quickly find the ones that are less innocent errors. We've also done a number of legislative changes in the 2013 session, and we have a couple of minor adjustments here that we think allow us to have more tools to better recover the overpayments when they do happen.
Could you comment on that? How aggressively do you go after overpayments?
Co-Chair Johnson, we try to balance being very aggressive about protecting the trust fund, but not taking people who are sometimes in a very difficult financial situation and making it impossible for them to repay. One of the things that we've done is we've really refocused our efforts on trying to get voluntary payment plans. Those are usually things that are long-term, more sustainable for the people that owe us the money, and frankly, less labor-intensive for us to monitor than trying to involuntarily collect the money. That being said, when we don't get voluntary payments, we offset against other unemployment insurance benefits people will receive. We intercept state and federal tax refunds that they would otherwise receive. We garnish wages. We put liens on property. So we do have a lot of tools at our disposal. Oregon had been and continues to be slightly above the national average for the amount of improper payments that are estimated to take place. We're actually doing better than the national average at recovering the overpayments, though, for the trust fund. So that's somewhere that we're doing quite well.
How much money is outstanding at this point?
Co-Chair Johnson, I don't have that figure off the top of my head, but I certainly will follow up and get that to you.
Give a sense of scale.
Total amount outstanding, I would guess it's over $100 million. In terms of scale, our benefit payments now, in 2014, we paid out about $620 million in benefits. Some of these overpayments that are outstanding are recent. Some of them may have been overpayments that took place one year ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, sometimes longer ago than that.
I guess I feel pretty strongly about, I know that some of these are very vulnerable populations and aggressive recoupment may not be a humane option. Conversely, your error should not be the functional equivalent of winning the Irish sweepstakes.
Co-Chair Johnson, I agree. And we do take our obligation to protect the trust fund, which is what we're doing when we recover those benefits. That's something that helps keep the tax rates lower for Oregon businesses, and we take that seriously. When I talk about our policy bills, we do have a couple of policy bills that are related to some additional recovery authority for us.
Thank you. Okay, please continue.
And another is just adjusting the unemployment insurance system. This is another challenge that we're dealing with to the changing conditions that we're in. And the changing conditions are everything from the different economic needs and circumstances that we face, and also the different ways that people like to communicate with us. This kind of relates to our technology issues, but people don't particularly want to get lots of letters from us in the mail. They prefer to hear from us electronically. Our computer systems were set up to work and to do things before the internet was in wide use. So we're working on making improvements there. But that has been something that's been difficult as we transition out of the recession. There have been some things that we're very proud about in terms of the accomplishments that we've done. We've consolidated some work units and some locations. So Lisa mentioned the call center locations, which was a very difficult move that our staff handled excellently, even though it was very challenging. It was the responsible thing to do. We also have combined some internal units. We're taking a really strong look at our performance standards, reevaluating them, setting new ones. That's resulted in a lot of increased efficiency from the staff that we have. we're working to better integrate ourselves, as Lisa mentioned, with the rest of the workforce system, so we're helping people get back to work. Oregon actually does well compared to most other states in terms of unemployment insurance working with the rest of the workforce system, but we're convinced that there's a lot more that we can do. We're engaged in a lot of cross-training right now so that my staff understand what the Business and Employment Services staff have to offer so we can better make those connections. Oregon was selected by the U.S. Department of Labor to participate in two studies, one regarding the WorkShare program, which is a voluntary program that lets businesses avoid layoffs. The other is the Self-Employment Assistance Program that helps people who are out of work start their own business. This is another area where Oregon is seen as a leader nationally, and we're proud to be helping the Department of Labor look at ways to improve these programs in Oregon and also help other states adopt or improve their programs. And then the last one I want to mention, because it is somewhere that we've really taken advantage of to try to limit the overpayments, is how we use our information. So we have some tools that let us take the information we have. It's helped both with our internal performance monitoring, but it's helped us detect some pretty complex fraud schemes as well and help protect that trust fund.
I want to go back just for a second to the self-employed assistance programs. Do you keep any statistics on how well that's working? Starting a business and becoming self-employed is not an easy task, and doing it well and having a product that people want to buy and maintaining profitability and operating within all of the required employment laws. Do you track how that works?
Co-Chair Johnson, we have some data. Frankly, one of the challenges that we've had is once people leave the self-employment assistance program, we lose a lot of the tools that we have to track how they're doing. We have some rough proxies, and the pilot project is actually working to help us get more longer-term data. The data that we do have shows, and I can get you more specifics, but I've been surprised at how successful businesses have been. There have been some high-profile, very large businesses that have started up. Certainly not all of them succeed. But I know we have some data, for instance, on so many months after they started up, how many of them are still around and how many of them have their own employees. So we can get you some information on that.
I would very much like to see that data. And then what kind of a screening mechanism do you have? Let's assume that I'm part of the long-term unemployed and I come in and I say, I'd like to start a business developing a new rocket propulsion system. I mean, that's preposterous. Who tells me no?
Co-Chair Johnson, we are not rocket propulsion experts, so we would not look at that and independently evaluate your business plan. What we actually do is we partner with the small business development centers. We developed, they used to do the initial screening for us, and because of resource constraints, they weren't always able to do that. They developed a tool that we use, and when there's cases that are kind of on the edge where they might qualify but they might need some more assistance, we work more closely with the SBDCs to get them that assistance. But we typically rely on the expertise of the SBDC to tell us, here are the types of things that are likely indicators of success, making sure that they at least have a well thought out plan, that they have a way to both develop their product if it's a product and to survive financially until they're able to start getting a regular income stream, a lot of those types of factors.
What are the sideboards on how much money can be offered? Or is it just technical assistance, or is it here's a sack of money, go be a rocket propulsion guy?
Co-Chair Johnson, the cap on the regular self-employment assistance program is what you would have received in unemployment insurance benefits. And the theory behind this is it's not supposed to be an additional burden on the trust fund, but it's supposed to identify people who would likely use up all of their unemployment insurance benefits and still be unemployed. So instead, we let them focus not on trying to apply for another job, but spend their time starting up their business. In terms of the technical assistance, that is something that we do not provide. And again, we refer to primarily the SBDCs and some of the other groups that focus on helping people start businesses.
I haven't quite beaten this to death, so let me take one more shot at it. So I come in, and there's a certain calculation of how much unemployment I would have received, and it adds up to some number. Pick up a reasonable number.
We can say $7,000.
Okay. And so I say I want to go into the rocket propulsion business, and I've got a business plan, and it's met muster with SBDC. Do you just give me a check at that point?
Co-Chair Johnson, no. What we do is we give you your regular weekly unemployment amount. So, for instance, if you would have received unemployment benefits of $300 a week, if you were out there trying to get hired on as an employee, we require you to report to us each week. You need to be actively pursuing your self-employment, trying to get your business going, and you can continue to receive the $300 a week until you exhaust the amount of unemployment benefits, that $7,000 in this hypothetical.
So it's functionally money that the person was due anyway, and you're trying to figure out a mechanism to kickstart entrepreneurship.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
I wanted to talk just real briefly, and this is another area where the Employment Department works with other agencies. There is a statutory construct, the Interagency Compliance Network. There's seven agencies, and the Employment Department is one of them, that are directed to work together on coordinated education of businesses and workers, and also coordinated enforcement. The idea here is that there's a lot of related employment laws, and to the extent we can cooperate with each other, share information, it can help all of us. This has been pretty successful. One of the ways that it's been successful is, for instance, the Employment Department has what we call a super auditor. So when she goes out on audit, she's looking not just for unemployment insurance taxes that are owed, but also amounts that are owed to other state agencies. She brings in an average of about $27,000 a month in taxes that had not previously been paid that we discover. About 60% of those are unemployment insurance. The other 40% are primarily either local transit taxes or workers' benefit fund assessments for DCBS or wage withholding for the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue also has an auditor like this, so this has been pretty successful. We did receive recently $500,000 in one-time federal money to do some additional outreach and enforcement regarding this. The ongoing improvements that we have, we're continuing to focus on accurate payments on all aspects of that. One issue, and I've spoken to Coach Gomberg about this, we do need to improve the way that we communicate with the public, and that's both the tools that we use, so again, moving away from paper and postal service and to methods that are more efficient and less expensive, and also the content of what we deliver, trying to make it more understandable to everyone that we're communicating with. We're starting to roll out some of those improved letters and forms and decisions, and we plan on using members of the public as kind of a focus group to determine how effective we've been in trying to rewrite the information for the public. We're continuing to work with our performance measures to refine those and make sure we're measuring the right things and being efficient. And the next one, modernizing our processes. We've started a lean process. We really have, as new programs get added, as new extensions get added, we add new steps to how we handle the system. And that's both how our staff handle it and our IT systems. We're using the lean process to unpeel the onion and get back to just what we need to do to handle the claims more efficiently and to handle the taxes more efficiently. The IT systems are a challenge for us. Trying to make minor changes to streamline things can have wildly unanticipated consequences, and it can be very expensive to make even seemingly minor changes to the system. So as Lisa said, we're really looking at what other states have done, and what we're trying to do is define what has worked well for other state unemployment insurance programs and implement that in Oregon, learning from the things that haven't worked so well so that we don't recreate that. And we do see that long term as really a key thing for us being able to be efficient and effective with the unemployment insurance program. And the final point I wanted to talk about was just four unemployment insurance related bills. And I'm just going to do this at a very high level, but I'm happy to get into more detail if you have questions. These are bills the agency proposed. Senate Bill 242 makes two changes that bring us into conformity with federal law after there were some changes at the federal level. There is a corresponding policy option package, 111, which has 2.5 FTE, four positions, to deal with the increased workload. the two changes that it makes. One is to the Treasury Offset Program, and this is the program that lets us intercept federal tax refunds to recover overpayments. We use that now for some types of debts. This would expand it so that it covers more types of unemployment insurance debts, and we'd have some increased recovery of overpayments and some delinquent taxes for the trust fund. It also makes the WorkShare program that I mentioned earlier a little bit more flexible and make sure that we treat the benefits the same as regular unemployment insurance benefits in terms of how it impacts employer tax rates using that magical mystery formula. Senate Bill 243 makes two minor changes regarding overpayments. The first change is just a clarification to explicitly state that we have the authority we believe we already have, and this is to have interstate agreements so that if someone owes has an overpayment where it was not their fault. So, Co-Chair Johnson, this is to your example of if we make an error or something gets changed through a hearing, so that if there's an overpayment as a result of that, other states can intercept the unemployment insurance benefits that they're owed in another state and give it to us, and we have that reciprocal agreement. It also slightly extends the time period for recovering a certain type of overpayment, a category of overpayments where the person did cause it, and it extends from 3 years to 5 years how long we have to pursue those. There is a corresponding policy option package 114, but there's no FTE or limitation impact from that bill. House Bill 2439 is just a procedural change, really. It allows the Employment Department to dismiss hearing requests when there's no longer really a dispute to be decided. In certain circumstances, right now, an administrative law judge has to dismiss the hearing request. This doesn't change the circumstances when it's dismissed. It just lets my staff do that instead of our having to refer it to an administrative law judge. That also has a corresponding policy option package 113, but no FTE or limitation impact. And finally, the last policy bill that we have is House Bill 2440. It makes a minor expansion of benefit eligibility. And right now, if you're required to leave your local area to apply for a job, sometimes you can end up not being eligible for benefits for that week. We don't think that incentivizes people to do everything they can to get back to work, so this would change that. The other change that it makes is that it says if you receive unemployment insurance benefits and later receive back pay for the same period of time, the back pay is considered earnings, so it would be an overpayment. And this is an issue that some of you may remember from the federal furloughs a while ago, where it's clear that under Oregon state law, generally people currently are permitted to keep both their back pay and the unemployment benefits for the same period of time. And that also has a policy option package, but we're not anticipating any FTE or limitation impact. Those are relatively small numbers of claims that are impacted. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Alex, any questions of Mr. Gerstenfeld? Okay, I have done a wretched job of time management, and so rather than starting the next two segments and getting 60 seconds into them, I would prefer, unless there is objection, to stop right now. And we will be visiting with our professional staff in LFO whether or not we would need to go over into Monday, and we will certainly let the committee know that that's the case. I apologize to the agency and to you all for my maladroit gavel. Senator Whitsitt, Representative Whitsitt.
I just want to say thank you for listening to my little outburst and to my committee members, too. I know we do have a psychiatrist in Klamath Falls, and I think we do have some sort of a program, but we're woefully, and just for the record, because I kind of said we don't have anything, but there's something, but it's really not enough.
We have a hideous addiction problem in Clatsop County, and we have no psychiatrist. Any other comments for the good of the order? Thank you very much for your patience with us today. We're adjourned. Patience with us today. We're adjourned. For your